Hi guys, today we have Canine Mike joining us, owner, trainer of Grassroots Canine up in Toronto as well as in Maryland. In today's live, we are going to talk about dog training, obviously, bite work, police dogs, decoying, markers, all of the mic in so we can get right to it. Thank you guys all for joining us. Hey.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Pretty good. On the hotel Wi-Fi, so I wasn't sure how it was going to work out.
Ah, okay. Well, we can see you and hear you. Where are you?
In Georgia right now. We're on our way back up from Florida to Maryland.
Ah, okay. So how are you splitting your time these days?
It's quite a bit of time in Canada right now, just with COVID and the lockdowns. Haven't been able to come back and forth as much as, you know, we would like, or everyone else would like to travel. So it's my first, you know, maybe every 3 months or so I get down to the U.S. right now.
Nice. So what are you doing in Florida or in Georgia? What are you doing there?
Well, it was a multi-purpose trip. We had a couple workshops, me and Carlos Ramirez. And also we're trying to purchase some dogs, to take back home to Canada right now, as again, with COVID, we're supposed to make a Europe buying trip, but that was kind of out of the question in February. So now we're just trying to kind of catch up.
Very nice. Doing what you can.
Yeah, exactly.
So before we dive into all these different topics, I wanted to talk to you about how you got started.
So I started off kind of not doing dogs. Like, I had pet dogs. I started off, you know, my daughter's making noise in the background. Sorry if you can hear. I went to school for psychology and sociology in regards to, like, humans specifically. I did counseling for about a year with dually diagnosed adults. So they would be like, for an example, would be they would have autism and schizophrenia. So pretty in like a group home environment. And I thought that's what I wanted to do. But when I was there, I realized, like, hey, I'm not really good at being empathetic and not sympathetic, where I would take a lot home with me and it would weigh on me quite a bit. And I wasn't seeing like a lot of what we would deem as like results. You know, it would seem kind of like the same, like Groundhog Day almost. And I was working dogs as a hobby on the side of that. Started like as a training decoy in French Ring. And, you know, one day I just came home and kind of had enough. And I was like, hey, I'm just going to do dogs and see how it goes. And that day is kind of, I've been here since.
A good transition. That's very, very heavy stuff. So when you say I just started to, you know, I wanted to train dogs, how did that work for you? Like, how did you get your start?
Well, when I made the choice that I wasn't going to do, you know, follow the typical psychology path, it was a pretty hard road. I couldn't find a job like anywhere. I would go to like regular daycare and kennels and apply, and I kept, they would see my resume and they wouldn't hire me. They'd be like, oh, you're overqualified. And they're like, this is a minimum wage position. I'm like, yeah, I don't care. I'll do it for free. I just want to learn. So, you know, I knocked on probably 30 different kennels doors, and one of the people kind of gave a hint that maybe they would consider me, you know, just being a kennel tech. And I showed up for probably like a month straight without being paid, just like, hey, what do you guys need? How can I help? Picking up poop. And finally, I guess I annoyed them enough that they hired me for minimum wage. And I was there working and got to do some, you know, regular daycare stuff. They had a trainer there at the time that would let me kind of shadow an apprentice. But I was putting in probably, you know, easily 60, 70 hour weeks and being paid for 40 hours at minimum wage. I would leave that job and go to like a local French Ring club in Miami and kind of annoy them enough that, you know, it was an older group of gentlemen, so they were kind of happy to have someone young there to throw in the bite suit. And you know, I guess I was the only stupid one there that would get in it and just get beat up by dogs. Had no idea what I was doing, but yeah, the bug bit me then, and That's
the rabbit hole.
exactly.
Well, you definitely paid your dues.
I'm still paying them, I think. Still.
So can you talk about Grassroots Canine and what you guys do?
Yeah. So we're based out of Toronto. Our main location is just north of Toronto. And we offer, you know, I would say about 80% of our business is like pet dog training. You know, we do everything from, you know, basic obedience with puppies up to behavior modifications with, you know, some not so happy dogs. The other side of the business is where most of my time is focused on like the police dogs and working dog aspect. So we're a vendor for police dogs up by us, as well as we travel and do seminars and workshops geared towards, as of lately, it's been geared towards police specifically, but from everything from obedience, detection work, tracking, bite work, anything that kind of falls under the umbrella of like a working dog in a police kind of environment. You know, that's where my passion is at this time. You know, in 10 years, maybe it'll be somewhere else. But we cover kind of all of that. And that's where my kind of expertise lies.
Very cool. So can you explain what is a police vendor?
Yeah. So what we do as police vendors is we try and, you know, not every dog has what it takes to be a police dog, just like not every person is going to make it to the NBA or to the NFL. It's very similar. So what we do, we're a small time or a more smaller vendor in that we don't have, you know, a kennel full of 150 dogs. You know, our max that we'll have at our main location would be 15 to 20 dogs. And that would be us maxed out. So what we do is we travel around or procure, or we breed sometimes, and raise dogs that are going to go into police programs that have, you know, the right genetics, the right health, the right temperament to make it in these police programs, which are pretty demanding of the dogs. A lot of times we get calls and they're like, hey, my dog, it growls when strangers come around. And like, hey, I think this is going to be the right dog. And what I don't think the general public may know is like, that's not a desirable trait of what we're looking for. We want these dogs to be maybe not super social butterflies all the time. Some of them can be, but we want them for the most part to be socially neutral. We don't want them to just see someone and think like, oh, that person is who needs to be targeted, because there's a lot more to police dogs than biting. Right. Biting, it's a super important part of what they do, but there's a lot more to it. And they got to be able to be around people. They have to be able to, depending on what level they're going to go to, sometimes they need to be able to be handled by multiple people and be safe and be clear of mind. So we try and really focus our, because we don't have the quantity of the 150 dogs, we try and focus a lot on the quality of the dogs that we can get.
So from when you are selecting a puppy for police work, what qualities are you looking for?
Yeah, so first and foremost, what I like to do is we test their environmental stability, or just so that they have solid environmentals. So, you know, them being comfortable walking in dark rooms on slippery surfaces, you know, maybe open graded stairs, things that can be a little bit intimidating to the average dog. Something that we do different is that I don't like to do it while the dogs are in drive. So I want them to be, you know, aware of what's happening around them, aware that they're walking on these open graded stairs, aware that they're on these slick surfaces. Sometimes, as you know probably fairly well, that Malinois can get blinded, or these working dogs can get blinded when they see a ball or something that they want. You could be able to kind of carry them through those without them noticing that they're in those situations. So first and foremost, we test that. And if I'm okay with them getting a little bit weirded out by things that they haven't seen, but what I really look for is that recovery time. Like, hey, if they get a little bit spooked by something, that's okay. There's going to be things that spook every dog. But what do they do after they get spooked? You know, do they sit there and are they just done? Are they shut down now? Or do they try and, oh, well, that was a bit spooky, and then work through it. And you know, that's something that we look for a lot. If they pass those, that like environmental testing, then I'll move on to hunt. So when I say hunt, it's pretty much fetch. We play fetch with them with a ball to start off with and do some field throws. So we'll just hold the dog by a collar, throw the ball in some long grass, maybe let the dog get a sight picture of the area that the ball dropped originally, and then let them go. What we look for in that turn of things is we want the dogs to be pretty intense about hunting and not just rely on their eyes for a long time. Usually what they're going to do is like, hey, where did it go? They look, and we want to see them make that transition from, okay, I'm not finding it with my eyes, let me default down to my nose. And then I'm not really concerned if they actually find the item or the ball that we threw. I try and apply numbers. So I try and say, hey, how long has this dog been hunting for this ball? So we try and have a criteria set. If they find it, that's amazing. If not, I just want to see that they're super committed to hunting for that ball and continuing to hunt for that ball. Is that making sense?
Yes. They want to be doing it. They're motivated.
Exactly. I don't like if they keep coming back and checking in with the handler, like, hey, give me a hint. Where is it at? Just go and keep looking for that ball until you find it or we stop you. It's kind of what the goal is. A lot of dogs, you know, as we get further along and we move from environmentals to hunt, there's a big portion, the majority of the dogs that don't pass already have failed in the environmental stage. So for instance, this trip, we tested about 10 to 15 dogs so far. And one of them, we've selected one of them, but the other 14, the other percentage failed in the environmental test. So we didn't even get to the hunts. So now if they pass the hunt test, we move on to like bite work. Again, like we try and make all of this stuff fair to the dog in the level of maturity that they're at. You know, I'm not going to test an 8-month-old dog the way that I would test a 2-year-old dog. We have to be fair to where they're at. But what we look for is pretty common there as well. I like the dogs to be forward in their attitude. I like to see a bit of possession. So when they're biting something, I like them to maybe like try and hold it and be excited about it that way. And after that, then we're off to the races.
How old are the dogs that you're testing?
Yeah, so generally the range that I look for the dogs, I like them a bit younger than I find most vendors. I like to get them around, you know, on the earliest, probably 7 to 8 months old. At the latest, I like a year and a half. I like to be able to have the dogs with me for a while and kind of build on what's there, not just get them in for a week and then move them. Because I want to know, hey, what this dog's strengths are, what their weaknesses are, and let that dog be more than just a number in my kennel. Like, oh, this is dog number 7. You know, every single dog we know by name and we have a relationship with, and, you know the history on that dog. So that's super important to me as well.
Mm-hmm. So who is breeding the dogs, and what does life look like from, you know, birth to 8 months when you come and test them?
Yeah, so we do breed dogs. When we breed dogs, they're not like, we don't sell the puppies. So that's a little bit like our puppy program is a bit different. It's hard to tell exactly what the other people that I'm getting the dogs from, like how their programs are, especially when we get them in from Europe. Mm-hmm. It's hard for us to know what that dog's background is. And that's one of the dilemmas that we run into, is that we don't know, like there can be conflict in training that's already occurred. Generally speaking, what most breeders are doing with puppies between that age is trying to let them be open and like as free as possible. So, you know, you imagine a super annoying pet dog that's jumping on the couch and picking up the pillow and knocking stuff off the counter. That's what they're kind of embracing, right? And they're saying, okay, they're generally, we look for annoying dogs is the easiest way to put it.
That makes sense. You want to keep them like high drive. You don't want to water down any of those qualities.
Yeah. We want them to just know and think that the world moves to the beat of their drum. And when they go out in the world, they make good things happen. and it's all up to them how things work out.
Very cool. Can you talk about, I've heard you talk about like activating your dog and like, can you just talk about, well, first off, like a proactive dog versus a reactive dog? What's the difference?
In regards to bite work specifically?
Bite work, I mean, just the dog in general.
Okay. Yeah, so the general rule of thumb is that what I look for in a dog, or what I really like in a dog, is a dog that's being proactive. And that comes in the form of bite work, in obedience, in detection, in any facet of dog training behavior. And what I mean by that is I want the dog to have the onus of responsibility on them to activate the game, to make things come to life. So I'm sure you've seen dogs when they're doing obedience, or like a trial kind of fancy obedience, where the dog needs to be kind of pepped up by the handler, like, hey, look at the toy I have, and look, now get into heel. Where I want to change that dog's mentality, where the dog is kind of almost bumping at the handler and being a bit like, hey, come on, like, let's do something, and the handler to life, for the handler to say, okay, fine, I'm gonna let you heel. Like, we try and change the mind state, where a dog being proactive thinks that it's controlling the world around it, but we're just doubling back on them and making them, really, we want them to heal, but it's kind of playing hard to get. Like, oh no, and, okay, fine, I'll let you heal right now. And then they're like, oh, so enthusiastic about it, without us having to kind of, get them.
Pull it out of it.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's so interesting because with pet dogs, you know, it's like those dominant traits, you want to, you know, water it down, wash it down. You know, the dog is pushing the toy into your legs, like, you know, come on, come on. And it's like, okay, you're in our world now. But with the
Yeah.
dogs that you're talking about, you embrace those and really
Yeah, and
like look
that's
for
why.
that annoying.
Yeah, with us, there's a huge dichotomy when we're bringing out, like, we'll have board and train dogs that are there for pet obedience, and we're like teaching them, like, hey, like, yeah, it's time to be polite, and I'm only gonna, reinforce you when you have all four paws on the ground, and you're doing all the appropriate pet behavior, and then we put that dog away, and then we take out, Satan spawn right after them. And they're backflipping and being what, the general public, or what we would be like, oh, this is a super rude dog. And we're like, oh, good job to this dog. So really important that we, one, have a criteria established on what we're working on. And that's why I think our trainers at our locations have, like, they have their hands full, because it's not just cookie cutter for each dog. Like, we literally are like, hey, if we're kind of reinforcing opposite behaviors on each, and it could be within, two sessions. There's a dog here, and then the next dog you might be doing the total opposite with. So I think that's makes it really challenging. And with pet dogs, I find a lot of the time we're trying to suppress that like dump of dopamine that they have, right? That over ex just that annoying behavior. But with our working dogs, we're trying to like increase that dump of dopamine. We're trying to say, hey, like, let's put some more on it. So it's back and forth, and one of the reasons why I like doing it and don't get bored is because it's different every time.
Very cool. Okay, now of the canine. What do you guys do if the dog is too friendly? Probably talking about police dog.
I haven't yet. If we've selected the dog correctly, part of it is just who the dog is, right? Like, you, I haven't run into a dog that we've selected that's been too friendly. We want them to be, again, like, social or socially neutral when it's not time to, the majority of that police dog's life is going to be him. It's not time to bite, right? Not at, like, the majority of things that it's going to do. So we haven't had a dog, once selection has been, like, that becomes a selection issue if the dog's just not, well, they'll say civil, like ready to engage an actual human being, which is very, in the grand scheme of things, very unnatural, right? We've domesticated dogs for so long, and kind of taught them, hey, don't do this, genetically, just, hey, don't put your teeth on us, and you can't do that. Now we're kind of almost doing the reverse when we're trying to find the ones that will do it, But it becomes a selection thing at that point. It's either, you know, you can have the biggest muscle bound person in the world and put them in a ring in UFC, and they might not want to fight. They're not just because they're big and muscular, and it's just not for them, you know? And that's how I look at that.
Mm-hmm. What does life look like for a police dog? Because I imagine that it's a lot of, you know, sitting around, like they're kind of like, I guess, I am not knowledgeable in this at all, but when I think of a police dog, I'm thinking of them like being in the car for a long time and then like having to switch drives like very quickly. Like how do they get, I guess, exercise? Like what's a normal day like?
Yeah, so I like when they get to where they're kind of their final destinations with their handler, that'll change quite a bit depending on, you know, what the policy is with that at that handler's agency and so forth. But usually speaking, you know, those they do have to understand what downtime is. Like it's not just go all the time. But they get a lot of work, you know, even if it's not work actually out tracking bad guys or finding drugs or whatever. You know, we have handlers that on their shift, they'll get in 3 to 4 training sessions. You know, it might just be obedience or it might be detection. They might have someone that'll go and lay a track. I've gone out at, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning because the handler was having a slow night and laid tracks for them and they came and found me. So they're, you know, the dogs want to be doing it the entire time, right? And it's kind of our job or the handler's job to be like, okay, we need to pump the brakes here a little bit and not let you get overboard. Because so many of these dogs will just, you know, work until they drop. So we have to say, hey, no, it's time to slow down a bit and you know, recoup. And so they definitely need to understand and kind of have a quote unquote off switch. But they got a lot of go too. When it's go time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what are the different, I guess, like fields of police dog work? There's.
So like detection. Like
detection, yeah.
So there's detection, which could be like narcotics detection, explosive detection. They even have, I haven't done one of these dogs yet, but they use them. I don't know what the appropriate name is, but they use them to find like SD cards and stuff for offenders, sex offenders that may be hiding them. So there's like huge arrays in just the detection field of it, like what they can do. They do evidence location. They have tracking. So, you know, someone gets out and runs from point A to point B, the dog needs to come and find where that person has gone. Then they have apprehension work. So that bite work, you know, inside of bite work, there's other avenues as well. So there's open area searches. Then there's building searches. There's just like a ton of things that dogs can be used for. And a lot of times, where dogs become beneficial or is that they can get arrests or make arrests happen without police or the dogs having to go hands-on with someone. So, you know, someone's in a building and they get out and they make their announcements. Hey, we're going to send the dog in. And so many times the perp in the building just says, okay, never mind. And comes out and gets arrested.
Wow.
Works almost as like a deterrent in the escalation of something, right? So it says, okay, well, instead of it getting to that point where they have to do it, I forget where I was reading it, but they're starting to really try and track those numbers as well. Because, you know, we'll have dogs that have been on the road and have, you know, for a year have 30 arrests, but only 2 of those arrests may be actual bites because someone has just seen that there's a dog there. The dog came out and said, okay, never mind. I'm going to turn myself in. All right.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's pretty powerful. It's amazing what the dogs can do. Good work. Yeah, that's so cool. So changing gears a little bit, can we talk about your experience with decoying and bite work?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what is the ideal bite?
that opens up argument time for people.
Okay.
My ideal bite is a dog that has a full mouth. So we can pretend that this is the dog's mouth right here. And a full mouth, we're getting a better angle. Let me hold something. Oh, lost my lighting. Sorry. So here, we got my Gatorade. So this is the thing that the dog's biting. This is the dog's mouth. A full mouth means that the dog's not biting just with the front. It's in the back of the dog's mouth, right? So all the way gripped in there. I like a full mouth. I also like the dog to be active while they're biting. Again, tapping into that proactive dog. I don't want them just to get a full mouth and just hang out here. I want them to get their full mouth and then continue to punch forward. So continue to continue and punch forward. When it gets to police dog stuff, one that goes into pain compliance on a suspect, but it also in the long run keeps the dog safer. In that, if they're just biting with the front of their mouth, all that pressure is just on a few teeth in their mouth, and they can break teeth. It also keeps, it kind of seems counterintuitive, but it keeps the person that the dog's biting safer as well. In that, if they're biting with the front of their teeth, they tend to shake quite a bit, and they can start pulling and tearing, and things get gross. Where if they're biting with a full mouth, they stay in that same spot, and they're just punching forward. So it's not a bunch of different puncture wounds everywhere. It's just right on that one spot. So I really like that biting style. I said it opens, when you ask the question, it opens it up for arguments, because just because I like that doesn't mean that everyone's going to like that biting style. Some people prefer a dog to bite with a full mouth and then be pulling on the bite. And it kind of just goes to different schools of thoughts. But my personal style of biting is I like that, and I like the dog to be proactive and not need a bunch of help. Just, hey, that's what you do. You keep doing that.
Makes sense. It's like a fish.
Yeah.
I just want to hop up. We had a question from Vanessa K9. Who's the best dog you ever picked up at the Detroit airport?
I think he made a mistake. He meant to say the most expensive dog that I ever picked up. His name was Vito. And it wasn't expensive from, I got it from Eric, but I got double taxed on him at the border, so his price went way up. So that's his name's Vito. He's actually a beast of a dog. He was a shepherd, Malinois cross, and he's out there keeping the streets of Western Canada safe.
Okay, you said he's the most expensive dog. What, how much is he running for? Just to give us a sense of how much these dogs cost.
So yeah, so expensive for, so when I get them in, the usual price range for the dog is around 75 to 8,500. So, and that's like when they come green, they're green essentially. So then we have to put the training and all of that on them, and then get them to to their agency. Vito was more than that because I got taxed like another, I want to say 4,000 or 4,500 at the border, because one of the border agents was having a bad day. I should stop talking just in case someone's watching right across the
Oh no. That's really funny. I don't even know if we should go on that topic, but
Yeah, we'll avoid, we'll have a conversation private one day.
okay.
I won't get into
But all right, so this is around 75, 8K, and then how much are these dogs going for once they go to the agency?
Yeah, so it depends. Sometimes the agencies want the dogs like pre-trained. The term like green dog is up for interpretation as well. So some agencies want a green dog, but they want it to have a foundation in tracking, and they want it to also have, a foundation in bite work. So for me, when I think of a green dog, I think of a dog that has none of that. It's just out the box. He hasn't had any training, and he just would just see what the dog naturally has. So depending on how much training the agency wants, the range will kind of move from, and like, let's say 12,000 up to maybe 20,000. And then if you put handlers courses and stuff into that, it can get a bit expensive. But I always say, like, buying a dog, an agency buying a dog, is the cheapest part of having a canine unit. Like that, when by the time they say, okay, how much their vehicle insert is going to cost, how much vet bills are going to cost, how much food is going to cost for this dog, the actual purchase of the dog is at the bottom of the list when it comes to that. But yeah, the price range varies quite a bit.
It would be really cool to see those stats, like the data of, the arrests and, even saying, we're sending the dog. I feel like that would be really helpful
Yeah.
in terms of like talking about cost and risk
And
versus reward.
also for the climate that we're in, right? Like a lot of time, like, it's not pretty when a dog bites someone. But if you see that, hey, this dog that for this one time, this was the best tactical decision for them to make, to keep, the perp safe as well as the officers and the dog. But hey, the dog's had 100 other arrests and it hasn't bit anyone on those arrests because just his presence there was enough to say to talk someone down from doing something silly. But if you ask other handlers or you get people on here, I encourage you to ask them, like, hey, how many arrests have you had with your dog where a bite wasn't a part of it? And I'm sure that those numbers are way, they're going to outweigh tenfold the amount of arrests that have had bites. And I think that it's important that, like, that message gets put forward as well, because they're overall just super useful, companions, but as well as tools in this, especially this day and age with what's going on.
Absolutely. Mike, how did you get involved with police work and training police dogs?
Yeah, I ask myself that sometimes, to be honest with you. When I was decoying at that French Ring Club in South Florida, there was a smaller agency that was coming out. Like, I don't know if the handlers were supposed to come out, but they were coming out and having their dogs work there as well. And I kind of gravitated towards doing that stuff instead of the French Ring stuff. I'm not, working police dogs and decoying in that stage where I was at was a lot more entertaining for me because there was like every week was something new. Like, oh, we're going to do a bite inside a car today. Oh, we're going to do a building search. Can you go in here and we're going to search with this dog? And to me, that was a lot more interesting at that time than, the French Ring stuff. The French Ring was, it's complicated in its own way, like in a different way, but that kind of pulled me more than the French Ring was. And then I went to school for criminology under that sociology kind of degree. So I was always kind of leaning towards that stuff. It was very interesting to me.
Very cool. Yeah, and it makes sense. All the real world stuff is,
Yeah.
more exciting, intriguing, and
Yeah.
real.
For me, it definitely it was, and it still is. I think that it's cool. Our group that we train with, we have like a bite club, and we have people that are training for PSA, some people training for IGP, some people that just want to work their dog. And so I like the mixture of things, so it's not just always the same thing over and over again. Doesn't with my type of personality. I like to mix things up, so.
When I cut that little highlight reel, I was going through your videos, and you have such a variety of training videos and different things that you do with your dogs. Like, how do you get creative? And like, what are some, like, okay, that scent bomb, the
The
bomb
smoke bomb.
video.
Yeah.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that and yeah, how you get creative training your dogs?
Yeah. So the smoke bomb specifically, we're just trying to think of things that are going to look a little bit different to a dog's perception and how they're going to see things. And I know that we had like fog machines that we would fill rooms up with sometimes and send the dogs into that. And I would see a lot of them kind of hit the brakes, almost that like it looked like a solid structure to them, like a wall was there. So I was like, yeah, I bet that this would be pretty imposing on a dog, and wanting to see how they feel about that. And well, I looked up, hey, where can I get smoke bombs? We grabbed some and tried it out with the dogs, and they did great. Although
Love it.
we tried it inside a like an old garage one time, and we got I didn't realize that it was like smoke, like actual smoke. So we pretty much smoked out the entire garage, and you know, I had red boogers for a few days. But
That's awesome. Not the red burgers part. Okay, grassroots canine just said, tell the garage story. Is that the garage story? Yeah, okay.
was the garage story.
Awesome. So there are so many people at home, COVID. What are some kind of like DIY things that people can do at home to make training more exciting?
That's a good question. I'm a big fan of like markers and marker training, just because I think that again it falls into that creating a proactive dog versus a kind of reactive dog, and that we make them specifically if we're using it as like free shaping, we make them want to go discover things and figure things out. So if your dog has a terminal marker that's really charged, you know, I would just inside the house, think of random things that you can make them do, right? And go about free shaping that. We can say, you know, teach my dog to open the fridge today, and you know, use your clicker. You can sit down on your chair and you can click away with your dog until they figure out, you know, exactly what you're asking of them. I think, you know, adding variety to your dog's life is also captivating to them, right? If they have to think and try and solve a new puzzle, it applies stress to them, but it's beneficial stress, right? It's if everything in life is super easy and there's no thought to it, it kind of sucks for us as well. So we want them to have a little bit of stress, but be able to solve that puzzle and be able to solve what we're asking of them. I think that can go, you can get super creative with that. So a lot of our clients do things of that nature. The other thing that we do a lot, even with the pet dogs, is we do like an article indication game. Where we use a coin, we use a penny or a dime, and we put it on the floor, and we teach the dogs that they have to find that, and we want them to passively indicate to that, and it really builds focus with them. And we just messed with a couple of the pets that were on our board and train one day, and we were doing it with our working dogs for a while, and we realized like, oh wow, this is a pretty fun game for these dogs. They really get like obsessive about it, and you know, we have some clients that'll hide, you know, this coin around their house on the floor and get the dog to go look for it. I think like little fun games like that.
Very cool. Can you explain the difference between operant conditioning versus classical conditioning?
So operant conditioning, in easier terms, is like learning by consequence. So consequence doesn't have to mean something bad or undesirable, but it just means something that happens after a behavior occurs. So most of us that have dogs are using operant conditioning, like, and maybe not even realizing it. You know, when we ask Fluffy to sit and Fluffy sits and then we give him a cookie, you know, that's operant conditioning, right? Where Fluffy put his butt on the floor. The consequence to putting your butt on the floor was I added a cookie to you, right? I gave you a cookie. So that would be positive reinforcement. In operant conditioning, there's four quadrants. So there's positive reinforcement, there's negative reinforcement, there's positive punishment, and then there's negative punishment. And the language of it makes it a little bit confusing because the positives and negatives, they don't mean like the good and the bad. Positive means we're adding something, and negative means we're taking something away. So when we then the reinforcement means something that's going to make a behavior more likely to happen again, and punishment means something that's going to make a behavior less likely to happen again. Is it making sense so far?
Yeah, it does. The last part, the punishment part, it just got cut off
Okay,
a
so
bit.
yeah, I was saying punishment just means something that's going to make a behavior less likely to happen again in the future.
And when you're training, what does the punishment look like?
Yeah, so punishment can be a huge variety of things. So in bite work, for instance, if I have a puppy and they're biting on a tug, and I'm able to take that tug away, like snatch it away from the puppy, right? And the consequence for it snatching for the puppy letting me snap take it out of its mouth is that it's lost access to this right now. Right now, he's not going to get the tug anymore. So that would fall into punishment, right? He lost access to this, and it's going to make that behavior less likely to happen again. So it doesn't always need to be like an e-collar stim as a punishment or a pop on the collar. We can use the environment, right? I can say, hey, here's food. I really want you to do something. You don't do it. You've lost access to this food. Right? Is that making sense?
Yes.
Yeah. So that would be negative punishment. You can, positive punishment would be something like, you know, popping a dog on a collar. I told you, you know, to leave it. You didn't leave what was over there, so I gave you a pop on the collar. Now we positively punished it. Mm-hmm. And then, so classical conditioning is kind of like learning by association. So like cues almost. So things that are established before a behavior. So I don't want to sound like preachy right now, because I feel like I'm coming off a little preachy. But
no, you're not. Not at all. No, it's good. It's
and I'm sure someone will be able to explain it a little bit better, but are you familiar with Pavlo? Ivan Pavlo?
He's the like psychology.
Yeah, like with the bell and the dogs salivating. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically I think we sometimes in the dog training community get confused with classical conditioning, because basically what Pavlo's experiment was, or unintentionally stumbled upon, was that this bell that was an insignificant thing to the dogs, he was able to make it signify that food was coming at first, right? Every time before they got fed, that bell would ring and the dogs would start to salivate. Then they would be fed. Eventually, the bell elicited the same response that the food did, in that the bell by itself made the dogs salivate. And what the key point that I think a lot of us miss out on, including me at times, is that salivation on the dogs was an involuntary response. Like, it wasn't up to the dogs to, they didn't consciously make the effort of saying, oh, the bell rung, now I need to salivate. Like, it's out of their control. So sometimes, and this is where I get, when we're using a clicker and we've classically conditioned a clicker, sometimes people click and they mean it to be a terminal marker, which means like, hey, the behavior you're doing is done. Now come to me and get food. But sometimes those same people will click and also want it to mean a continual marker, which means the behavior you're doing, keep doing that and I'm going to come and give you food. Mm-hmm. Right? And if the dog's having to think that through mid behavior, then it's no, to me, that clicker is not classically conditioned yet, because it's not an involuntary response. Mm-hmm. Is that making sense?
Yes. Yes. So, and in this case, do we want the clicker to be the bell?
Exactly. We want the clicker to happen, and then it's out, whatever we've conditioned is out of the dog's conscious control to what it does. Right. Mm-hmm. So if I've conditioned my clicker to mean terminal, hey, behavior is done, come to me and get food or get reinforcement, then I don't also want to use that clicker to mean stay in behavior. Mm-hmm. Because then they're having to think too much, and if they're thinking about it, it's not an involuntary response, and then it's not classically conditioned. Mm-hmm. I just want it to mean one or the other. It either means stay in behavior and I'm going to come and give you something, or it means behavior is over. And for me, with my working dogs, I use a lot of terminal markers. So behavior is done, come to me. And I barely use any continual markers. But with our pet dogs, I use a lot of continual markers and still use a little bit of terminal markers as well. Because I found with terminal markers, I elevate a dog's dopamine levels, right? That dopamine, that's that neurotransmitter that says, oh, there's something good that's about to come, right? It could dopamine raises because of anticipation of a reinforcement, right? So when I click and they get to explode out of the behavior that they were doing and run back to me, it's a huge dopamine dump for them. But if I give them a continual marker and they stay in behavior, it's not a dopamine, as big of a dopamine dump anymore, because that anticipation isn't, it's like, oh, well, you're still coming over to me. And in my experience, I haven't hooked dogs up to gauges to measure what those dump levels are. Mm-hmm. But That's truly what I believe and what I've seen practicing, that hey, if I want them to kind of flatten out in behavior, I reinforce them while they're in behavior. If I want them to have that explosiveness in behavior, I click and pay them out of behavior.
For the continual marker, are you talking like good or like that type of
Yeah,
mark?
so continual, it can be whatever you, so I don't use the clicker for a continual marker. I use the word good, right? So you can use good. Some people do use a clicker for a continual marker. And that just, again, you can, it doesn't matter what it is. I also use whistles for terminal markers, and I use I use yes for another terminal marker. So it doesn't matter what the sound is specifically. It's just having, continuity and being consistent with what you're using that particular sound for. If it's a continual, it always stays a continual marker. If it's a terminal, it always stays a terminal marker. For me, that's how, what makes the most sense in my brain and how I've seen the dogs perform while I'm working them the best. I think, anyone that owns a dog knows that, when we give a little bit of gray area for them, they get a really big mixed message. So I try and whatever we're trying to eliminate, whatever gray area is possible to be there. That's just where I'm at right now. Like 10 years from now, I might be onto something and say, oh no, wow, I was doing that like a goof. Like I was at our workshops, I always tell people, hey, if you spoke to me, 6, 7 years ago about a clicker, like I was the guy that was like, oh yeah, clickers, oh, you're gonna click my dog and it's gonna, like, that was me, So what I like about this is that, we can continue to progress, and I'm not married to any of the ideas. Like, I'm just like, hey, this is the best way that I've figured out to do it right now. Hopefully next year I have a better way.
Okay, Karen the decoy, how much classical conditioning do you think happens by accident in training?
I think tons of classical conditioning happens by accident, and I think a huge portion of the problem behaviors that pet and working dog owners run into comes from accidental classical conditioning. The easiest example in like a pet home that I can think of is a dog being excited at the doorbell, right? Doorbell rings. Every time the doorbell rings, something exciting happens at the door. But now we've classically conditioned an involuntary response on our dog's behalf to explode and be, maybe bark or maybe lunge and over to the front door. So I think it's important that we understand classical conditioning, because traditionally what we would do is just immediately correct that behavior, right? Is apply an undesirable consequence. But if we understand that, hey, we've made it an involuntary response on the dog's behalf, then it's not really fair to correct the dog for that behavior, because it's not, they're not making a conscious choice. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yes.
Just like they didn't make a choice to salivate. They're not making a choice to bum rush the door when the doorbell happens. We taught them that in unintentionally. So we need to kind of battle those things a different way. And then maybe we get to the point eventually where we start saying, okay, now there's a an undesirable consequence for doing that. But first we have to extinguish that.
Makes sense. Okay. Can you click or train your husband?
So can't tell you if that's the answer. I tried with my wife and it didn't work. It was did the opposite.
I think markers is the best thing that I've learned and has been the most useful, like in my own training with Rika, understanding like the continual marker versus the terminal marker.
Yeah.
So I think like when you're training and you have treats, you want to always reward, but then it's really important to take a step back and actually think, oh, how is this dog actually learning what I'm asking them to do? Because there's a difference between like I say like a sloppy behavior
Yeah.
and like clinging, like, okay, this is what there's a difference, and obviously there's levels.
Yeah, no, for sure. That marker, outside of the clear communication to the dog, it also gives clear communication to the handler, right? We can see like, oh, my timing was really off when I just issued that marker. So it gives us the ability, I find, more real time to be able to adjust like on the fly, right? If I push a clicker and I was trying to click when a dog's butt hit the ground, but it stood up and then I hit the clicker, it's way more obvious to me that, oh, I was off right there. And now I just taught the dog stand up a little bit and then I'm going to pay you. So it really helps us in that kind of realm. I'm also a huge fan of recording my sessions like on video, because I watch them over, and while I rewatch those videos, I start to see like, oh, there was a mistake right there. Oh, I should have did that better. I should have, my timing was off right here. And you put markers into that, it really makes it clear when you're off and it's on video.
It's so funny because, you know, we started the Instagram like in May, and I've been sharing videos from the start, and you know, I naturally record, and I've had so many people like point out different things, like, you know, you're saying, you know, point out me not using the markers correctly, or like me rewarding at different times. And it's really fast tracked my training because it shows me, hey, I'm doing that wrong. Don't do this and that. So that's one benefit of recording and sharing.
I got a question for you. What kind of piqued your interest to get into this
with Bright Gun? With having a Mal or like in the dog world?
All of it. Having a Mal and in the...
Yeah. So I grew up with a German Shepherd and a Collie. And in my early 20s, I rescued a Chihuahua. My ex and I, Dave, we wanted to get a dog, and he was dead set on a Malinois. And I loved all the qualities and thought they were amazing dogs, but I was very concerned about the commitment. Like, holy shit, you know, it's a lot, like all the, you know, mental and physical stimulation, blah, blah, blah. I think, and this is what happens with Mals, like people love what they can do, you know, they see John Wick and want the Malinois, but don't know the time that goes into it. So we got Rika, and yeah, and I mean, I have really fallen in love with Rika and the breed in general, and connecting with really smart, passionate people. I'm learning so much and very, very inspired. So it's like every day I'm peeling back another layer and going more and more into the dog world, down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, rabbit hole, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. And it, not that I'm anyone, you know, that's super deep down in that rabbit hole. But to, you know, the day that it stops for me is the day that I stop feeling like there's more interesting stuff out there, right? When I'm like, oh man, I can do this better, or what is that? And I'll go down the rabbit hole, even on things that I right now adamantly disagree with. Because like I said, you know, 7-8 years ago, I adamantly thought clickers were ridiculous. So I'm like, hey, I've still wanted, like, you know, having that thirst and chasing after, just more and really enjoying it. And I could tell that you really enjoy what you're doing with your dog as well.
Yeah, it's definitely very, very special. And I think it's so cool because everyone is, one thing, like the goal with these Q&As is everyone learns differently and digests information differently based on like who they're hearing the information from. So I love getting to talk to different people and hear how they share information. And a lot of the information is all very similar. But you always are learning more and hearing different perspectives. And I think it also makes the community a little closer. I remember when I first started, you know, I always hear like the dog world is so toxic. And like, yeah, of course, like any field is going,
yeah.
There's always going to be that stuff, but it doesn't matter what industry. But I have found that there are a lot more people like willing to share information and see the positives in other people and techniques and yeah.
I think that's a big thing. You know, I'm and maybe business wise, it's not a great model, but if I have information or something that I think is useful, or people will find interesting or useful, like there's no like secrets. I don't try and like huddle info over here and be like, oh, you're just going to get, you know, a piece of it. Sign up for the subscription or just, hey, like what I have. And I do it because I also, you know, there's isolated pockets throughout, you know, the world or the country where people don't have access to, you know, someone else that can help them or they can do training with, or they may think that they're interested in, you know, detection work. And I'm like, hey, if I can put some stuff out there that people will, you know, kind of enjoy or some content that people will enjoy, I'm all for it because I do this, man. If I'm not working a dog or don't have a dog with me, you know, the majority of my time is watching dog videos or reading, you know, research articles about dogs. Like everything is, you know, if I can help contribute to that, that's what I want to do. You know,
Always pay it forward. Honestly, you get so much more back.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, okay. G-Steezy, 4-month-old Malinois needs help. How to build her self-esteem when strangers and people engage her. She starts barking like crazy.
So what I would say is that, and we're going to go back onto the markers really quickly. For things like anytime that there's behaviors like that, where the dog is already, she's young and she's starting to show barking and kind of maybe lunging at people like crazy. If we have a marker system charged with her, a terminal marker, it gives us the ability to kind of engage her a little bit more. And the ability to also reinforce her at the speed of sound, right? So as soon as that click happens, there's so many micro behavior shifts that happen before she goes from not barking to barking that we've probably already missed the opportunity to reinforce what we wanted to. Whereas if we have a terminal marker and she's, you know, 6 feet away from us, we give her the marker. Again, she has an involuntary response to that marker because it's classically conditioned, and she turns around and comes back to us. The other thing is about identifying her thresholds, right? If when you go out with her and you see groups of people, you know, maybe at first try and stay 100 yards away where it's doable. And then if she's taking food from you over there, awesome. Slowly, and it may take weeks, right? Slowly then move to 80 yards away, then work her right there. And if you hit, let's say, these are just random numbers I'm throwing out, but just to get the point across, if you get to 50 yards away and she stops taking food from you, but she's not barking at that person yet, you've already still passed that threshold where you can work her, that ideal threshold. So I would move back to 60 yards then and work her there again. The first thing that you're going to see, usually the first telltale sign of you've gone too far, is that a dog is not trying to engage with the food that you have in your hand.
Okay. Did you get that, G-Steezy? All right. This is a question for me. If I want to work with Rika at home and work on her biting and doing the full grips, what are some exercises that I can do?
I see you play tug with Rika, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so one of the things that you can do is to reinforce her the same way that you would want her to, if she's actually biting on a sleeve or on someone, with a tug. So, you know, when she counters and moves forward and really bites in how you want her to bite, at those moments, you can let her win the tug. There you go. That's the easiest way. The other way is to kind of become a squeaky toy. So, you know, when she gets to that right spot and has that full mouth on the tug, you give her a little squeak, you know, you say, ow, make a little noise for her and it comes back to life a little bit. Then you wait, she does it again, give her a little squeaky sound and, you know, intermittently kind of do that and also slip in and let her win. That's the easiest way at home to kind of do it. The other thing is utilizing back pressure or like a back tie while you're playing tug whip. If you use a back tie, it makes it a lot easier, right? You can kind of Skinner box that scenario where there's not a lot going on, and you just opposition reflex. She bites it, you kind of lean, pull it away from her a bit, then give her a split second to adjust. If she adjusts, yeah, lean back away from her. And just get those reps in. The cool thing about those behaviors is that we can also, to an extent, kind of classically condition that as well, right? So we can classically condition, hey, when you feel back pressure released, her involuntary response can become to drive in and punch forward, right? So a lot of times that's what we do when the dogs are going through our program is we want it to be an involuntary response. So we build that into our bite system as well. All of the work that we try and do is following the frameworks of operant conditioning or classical conditioning, because those people that figure that out are way smarter than us, and it makes it easy or easier to just say, okay, what do I like, what don't I like, and use that framework as the basis for what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. I definitely need to do the back tying. I've been getting very creative with my tug games and changing it up with different materials, and yeah, gotta do the back tie. So what'd you say?
Have you used any leather with her, like a leather wedge or tug?
I actually was just, I had the leather cloth and, well, two different tugs, one the leather bite cloth and then the cowhide one.
Okay.
And just switching it back. Yeah, but I want to do the back tie. Actually, she did it once, actually, with Jonathan. That was like her first experience doing bite work with someone else. You know, it's just us do training. But Jonathan Katz put her in the harness and like had her on the box and like did the whole thing. Yeah, we only did that once. She did good. She wants the bite. You know, we trained a lot of obedience stuff, but I mean, she loves it. She's a Malinois.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. All right, Mushmallow. Why won't my dog tug a tug, but tugs a ball like crazy? Did I introduce the game wrong?
Doesn't mean you introduced it wrong, but you have to also remember that your dog will. If your dog has the option to decide what it gets the tug on, then it make decisions because have preference. If we remove the option and say, hey, if you want to tug with me, you can only tug on this, and this is your only option for this, you increase the likelihood of your dog figuring it out, right? If they say, well, I don't like tugging on that toy, but I like tugging on that other one, and we just, okay, here's the other one, then we're letting them make choices in that moment, and they'll always get preferences.
Donovan Anderson, is it true that crating a dog after a training session allows them to think about that session? Is that really happening or no?
I don't know if it allows them to think about that session. So I do use the crate for negative punishment if I'm doing training. So if I'm doing detection work and I'm working on focus on the odor, which just means I want the dog's nose to stay where the odor is. And the dog breaks that focus, I'll immediately remove access. So I'll remove access to that odor or the possibility of reinforcement and then put the dog in a crate. So I don't know if the dog, like to me, the learning is not happening while the dog is necessarily in the crate. And it's like, oh man, I'm missed out on that. But where the immediate learning happens as a consequence to the dog breaking focus, right? And I say, oh, you broke focus. You lost your opportunity for this now. And then I'll put him away. I think some learning can happen through social learning in that sometimes I'll take out a more seasoned dog, more seasoned detection dog, and work them in front of that dog while it's in the crate. So then the dog kind of just gets frustrated, right? Like, oh, I want my turn. Let me out. But yeah.
Okay. Karnica Bites, do you have any favorite scent games for puppies? Great question.
To be honest with you, my favorite scent game with puppies is just getting them to hunt for their food. I don't introduce them to target odors really young. I know like quite a bit of successful people do introduce them to target owners. I like just getting them to hunt for their food. So you know, sometimes I'll take their food and, you know, in a bowl and hide it. Other times I'll take, you know, their food and throw it in the grass. If we have grass and it's not snow, I'll throw it in the grass and let them go out there and hunt for the food that way.
What do you think about calming, resting the dog after play? Do they need to shut off?
I think that's a little bit subjective in that it depends on what your goals are with your dog. Like if I have a dog that's going to run around the house with me, and I go outside and play, and then it comes into the house and is jumping back and forth on furniture and getting crazy, I definitely would want them to know how to, you know, calm and rest themselves, and be able to turn it off. But like our puppies, I have my expectations, like I said before, of puppies is like, I want them to be kind of obnoxious and like overbearing. So I don't teach them that it's their world. Whatever they want to do, they get to do it. So.
fun town over by you. advice on how to build the relationship and engagement so the dog turns to you for direction.
Yeah, this kind of goes hand in hand with that. Creating like a proactive dog with you. If we teach them that you know, all good things come from you. The easiest way to do this, to be honest with you, is existential feeding, which means that every calorie that dog takes in comes from you. So if your dog gets 4 cups of food a day, that means in the morning time you measure out the 4 cups, and throughout the day, that's your dog's sole source of eating is through you and doing things for you. Some people refer to it as hand feeding, but that's going to immediately impact that engagement and that bond, because you're that resource. You have to also, if you start to look at things like, hey, your dog's time with you is a resource in itself. Right? Your dog being with you is a resource. I mean, you manage that time accordingly and say, hey, if I take my dog out and I want to work on obedience, and I take it out and my dog says, nah, gives me the finger and says, not right now, and wants to go do something else, I say, okay, I don't beg them to engage with me. I just say, we'll try again in 20 minutes. I put them back in their crate and I go about my day. Eventually, that dog is going to make the decision that, okay, this guy's really important. I need to engage with him. That being said, when I'm taking them out of their crate and we're doing those first initial sessions, I'm also not doing it in the middle of a dog park or in an area where there's, you know, 30 different toys laying around on the floor. It's a very sterile environment, me and the dog and nothing else. So the dog gets out. If they decide they don't want to engage with me, there's nothing else for them to go self-reinforce on. And I say, okay, I put them away. Eventually, they engage with me.
Mike, so we're past an hour. How are you on time?
Do you? I'm good. I'm good as long as you're good. Okay. I'm just sitting in a hotel. So.
Okay. All right. Tatsby Jammas. How can we redirect my friend's dog from jumping up and getting excited and then starts nipping after 5 jumps?
Good question. One, it's hard to give specific advice without knowing exactly or like seeing the behavior. What I would say, you know, if we look at operant conditioning, we have to punish the behavior of jumping up, right? So how that dog's temperament and attitude is going to determine how we punish that behavior. But outside of just punishing the behavior, he also needs to have a replacement behavior. I don't like just punishing behavior and then leaving a dog stuck in limbo. Right. So if a dog jumps up and we correct the dog for jumping up, I don't like it just standing there and like not knowing what's next. Right. Or not knowing what to do. So one, we try and eliminate that behavior through, you know, correction or punishing it somehow. But two, we also have to teach it what the appropriate behavior is. Right. So if I don't like you to jump up when you meet people, I want to teach you maybe, hey, go to your place when someone comes to the house, or you can walk up and say hi, keep all 4 paws on the ground. And again, if we have a marker system loaded, we can really get our timing right with that, because as soon as a dog sees someone, before he has a chance to jump up, we click, the dog comes back to us, we pay him.
Awesome. Okay, day with Oreo. Can you explain the use of print collars?
I'm unfamiliar with what print collars are.
Me either. Oh, this is a question I had for you. What's the difference in training when it comes to police dogs and sport dogs? How are they trained differently?
So for me, foundationally, I train them the same way. In as far as bite, sorry. Are you there?
Yeah.
All right. As far as bite work goes, I train them foundationally pretty much the same way because at the early stages in their development, we're just teaching them technique. Like we're teaching them, what the criteria for biting is, what the bite mechanics are that we want. So if that dog is going to go into sport and then do IGP, they like a full mouth but pulling bite. So then we just say using our framework of operant conditioning, okay, well I need to positively reinforce when the dog's pulling instead of when it's pushing, right? So that framework is pretty much the same. Outside of that, I personally don't compete in any sports as of right now. Some of our club members do, but what they do with their dogs that are different than what we do with the police dogs is they do a lot of handler engagement and focus exercises. Where with young police dogs, I don't do so much focused on engagement with the handler because I for our dogs that are going to like the tactical teams, they need to be able to range out and work independently. And not be so obsessively focused on their handlers. Like, having an obsessively handler focused dog in sport could be really beneficial. Whereas in, some of those applications, it won't be. So the first thing that I do with our police dogs outside of bite work stuff is I teach them like go away from me behavior. So like sending them to a place board or, taking food and throwing it out for the puppies to go hunt for. I teach them like the away from the handler behaviors first. I find that it doesn't actually impact too much engagement when they get older, except because we're using a terminal marker. So they go out, do something, and then always come back to get reinforced anyway. So that's where the main difference to me would be.
Makes sense. I mean, the working, maybe there's a change of handler and.
Yeah, exactly. And like, a police dog, they might say, hey, this is a 10,000 square foot warehouse. We got to send the dog in to go hunt and see if it, right? Where generally a happening
I need you.
yeah, that I'm aware of.
Question, how do you train the perfect send away?
That's a great question because I like to use place boards and if we're doing like ranged out behaviors, we start with a bigger place board and then you can go to touch pads or things of that nature. That's probably what I would do. I haven't trained the perfect send away, so I can't answer that, unfortunately. I wish I could.
I guess the like with actually I'm not even gonna ask about that. Can you talk a little bit about the exercises that you do with the box, like for detection, like intro to detection?
Okay, yeah, for sure. So once we have the dogs again classically conditioned to that terminal marker, we have detection boxes. They're about a cube that's a foot by foot by foot, and a circle on the top or a hole on the top where the dog's nose can go in. We free shape, so we have a Skinner box set up where there's not a bunch of options again. We have just one box in the room originally, and there's odor inside that box. The dog goes over and puts its nose in the hole because there's nothing else to do in this box. Maybe they originally don't put their nose in the hole, but they get close to the box, and then we use successive approximation, which is kind of the hot you're getting hotter game. As they get close, we click. They come back. We feed them. They go over. Eventually, they get their nose in the box, and then we just get them to free shape. they decide to hold their nose into that box, and we just wait them out and click and bam, and slowly they start to determine, you know, in their mind, it's self-discovery, right? In their mind, they're like, whoa, I put my nose in this box and there's this smell in here and it produces what I want, right? Mm-hmm. So they're the geniuses in it. They think that it's all their idea and it's better that way. Then we just slowly start adding more options. So then we put another box that may have, you know, the same food reinforcers that we have, that we're giving them in the box. And then they need to choose, okay, I'm going to stay with this odor, and slowly add and add until, you know, they're really proficient on realizing, hey, that odor is what's important. And it almost gets to the point, I believe, that that odor becomes classically conditioned. So they start to have involuntary responses when they come into that odor, because it's produced something for them every time, just like Pavlov's bell, right? We get big changes of behavior, they lock up, and it becomes super solid.
Well said. Okay, do you want to give your opinion on shock collars and prong collars? Up to you.
Yeah. I don't call them shock collars. I call them e-collars. We use e-collar technology specifically. It's the brand that I prefer. I find it to have like the cleanest kind of stim so far. I've tried most of the main brands. And I'm a fan of prong collars as well. I can't even really say I'm a fan. I'm indifferent. I use them. But to me, I forget who said it, but someone was asked their opinion on prong collars and e-collars as well. And they said, I don't really have that big of an opinion on it because it's a tool. And like, it's like, what's your opinion of a hammer? What's your opinion of a drill? Like, yeah, all of these things can be used poorly, but it doesn't, they can also be used to build houses. And right. I think the e-collar is a widely misunderstood tool. And I think that we're just now kind of getting on the brink of understanding, you know, what the possibilities with an e-collar are. You know, the majority of communication with dogs on an e-collar should be at levels that are barely anything, like barely even recognizable, like maybe a little bit annoying. But I've used e-collars and prong collars and slip leads and harnesses. They're all tools and I'm fans of. I think they can be useful in the right situations.
Agreed. Last question, and then I'll let you go.
All right.
What is your favorite memory from all the use and the different dogs that you've been training? Favorite memory?
Ooh, that's hard. And probably after we get off here, I'm going to be like, oh, I should have said this. Or I should have. My favorite memory is probably like my daughter. I have two daughters. My 7-year-old is super into this. Her name is Brielle. She's really into the dog training side of things, specifically like the working dog stuff. She bothers me all the time to get into the bites. So, you know, just I think all in all, like seeing the passion that she has for it overall is kind of just a big memory for me that I enjoy, you know. So it's still making those memories right now. But that's my biggest.
Aw, that's so nice. And I'm sure she's inspiring you to keep building and.
Oh, she tells me wrong all the time. She's really good. She tells me when I'm wrong all the time.
Really love it. That's good. Well, I want to thank you so much for doing this live and appreciate you sharing all of your knowledge. Also, the amazing work that you're doing for owners at home, but for the police, the agencies. I mean, you're doing a lot of great work and you're also making good content. So thank you for sharing all of that.
No problem. Thank you for inviting me on here. It was great speaking to you.
I will talk to you soon. And if any other memories pop up, let me know.
I will.
All right. Have a good night.